Hello, and welcome to State of the Revolution. The political revolution gathering across the country today is led from the grassroots up, powered by people from across the political spectrum, organized by our common values, goals, and circumstances. The revolution is a movement beholden to no political party, organizing to find, understand, and use the tools available to change the world, modifying or building new tools as necessary. Our election system is a tool designed by wealthy white men who owned land, kept slaves, and feared democracy, designed to ensure perpetual rule by the tiny minority of people just like them. For centuries, our forebears have fought, bled, and died to expand the vote to black, female, and poor people. They left us a tool better than the one they found. It's our turn now. On November 6th, across the state of Michigan, we'll be going to the polls to vote on two proposals that are directly related to voting rights, Proposal 2 and Proposal 3. Today on State of the Revolution, I have with me Fred Fry, a Lansing attorney and voting rights activist, a volunteer with Promote the Vote, the organization behind Proposal 3, and also Kelly Collison, chairwoman of the Michigan Democratic Party Progressive Caucus, to discuss Proposal 3, its implications for voting rights, and what the next steps are after that. So first I'd like to turn it over to Fred and ask you to tell us about Proposal 3, how it affects voting rights, and why you support it.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned values, Leonie, because that's really what we start with in terms of fairness to people, all of whom should be able to vote that are fully registered and qualified. But there have been roadblocks placed in the way in a number of states, including now a little bit in Michigan, but many other states have adopted an approach to saying, well, we want our people to vote, but not those people, the others. So Proposal 3 is originally started out with the name Promote the Vote. Mm. And so that entails the making sure that people have the actual right in practice to vote, mm-hmm. and that their votes will be counted fairly. Mm-hmm. It's supported and was originated by three main groups, which are the ACLU of Michigan, the NAACP, and mm-hmm. the League of Women Voters. Mm-hmm. And it consists of eight separate parts which mm-hmm. would amend the Michigan Constitution mm-hmm. to make sure that the people that have a vested interest in maybe having some groups not vote mm-hmm. to make sure that those people can vote in a fair election. Mm-hmm. So fair and honest voting mm-hmm. is really the linchpin. We also talk, our Constitution talks in terms of due process. Mm-hmm. And what I've been taught right along in political science and law school mm-hmm. is that due process is mm-hmm. fair play. Mm-hmm. So that's the basic impetus for Promote the Vote. Mm-hmm. Those eight changes would include protecting the right to vote by secret ballot. We mm-hmm. do have a secret ballot now, but only because of statute. Now, mm-hmm. it's not in our Michigan Constitution. Mm-hmm. Make sure that military people have the right to have their votes counted so that they get their ballots 45 days before the election. Mm-hmm. In fact, our one Secretary of State's candidate whose spouse was in overseas mm-hmm. fighting, their ballot was returned to them mm-hmm. Before that person had the opportunity to vote. So mm-hmm. making sure our military people sure. get the right to vote. Registering citizens with the Secretary of State when they are registering for their driver's license mm-hmm. almost automatically, unless mm-hmm. they decline. Nobody has sure. to vote. But to make it as easy as possible to register to vote, mm-hmm. to allow citizens to vote to register by mail up until 2 weeks before the election, and on the same day if they show up with proof of residency and up to any time before the election is over. And to provide all registered voters with access to absentee. Mm-hmm. Right now, I can vote absentee because of my age. Mm-hmm. But other people that may have two jobs or mm-hmm. may be expecting a child,
sure.
makes it very difficult for those people to vote absentee without mm-hmm. having the right to do so automatically. So mm-hmm. that would be guaranteed under this proposal. Mm-hmm. allowing voters to vote with a straight ticket voting, which speeds up the process of voting. If people know that they're going to vote for one party, whether it's Republican or Democrat, if they know they're going to vote for all one person, for 127 years, they've had the right to vote straight ticket in Michigan. That is not the case now, and that's actually illustrative of why this proposal is necessary, to put it in part of the Constitution. But we can get more into that.
You mean to put it in the Constitution rather than leave it under the hands of the legislature, who have repeatedly demonstrated, for example, in the way they gerrymandered in 2010, and again, not just Republicans who happen to do that in Michigan, but as the one of the best other examples is Maryland, where the Democrats do it. So it's not a partisan thing at all. We need to take access to the ballot and the power to put blocks in front of that away from people who have a vested interest in maintaining their own position in the government.
Precisely. And actually, the Michigan legislature, just before the 2016 election, took that straight ticket voting away, which was ruled unconstitutional by the federal district court. But that was recently overturned by the U.S. Court of Appeals. And so right now, and everyone should know, that they don't have the right to vote straight ticket in the 2018 election in Michigan, unlike the previous 127 years, which this would restore that right.
Right.
And then to ensure the accuracy of the and security of elections, to call for an audit that's triggered, and that some of the details of these principles would actually be delegated to the legislature and to the rulemaking process to make sure that they're implemented. But the basic eight provisions are the ones that I just outlined.
Sure. That's great. That's a good explanation of the laws, of the proposal as I understood it as well. I just want to point out, I'm not promoting these in particular, but actually Ballotopedia has a nice chart. If you go there, they have a nice chart that lays out where the law is now, what the changes would be, and what the consequence of that would be. So that'd be a good place
to look at that. Another way to access that information is, and an explanation thorough, is promotethevotemi.com.
Promotethevotemi.com.
Yes.
Okay, great.
And that's got some more rationale about the reasons for this online too. So if you want to, if people want to get more information about it, promotethevotemi.com.
Right. So I've got some other questions, but I want to go over to Kelly, and because I know that you had some problems originally with the straight ticket voting part of this, maybe with other parts as well. Can you tell us a little bit about where you were at and what changed your mind?
Yeah, actually, for the last couple of years, I've heard a lot of people, especially a lot of Democrats, say, we need straight ticket voting. Straight ticket voting is so important. And, you know, the main reason that was always said was because of lines at the polls. And I thought, well, we should just have more polling places then. And then
we should do that, too. Obviously.
Yeah, we should. We should definitely still do that. But then I voted absentee this year because I'm going to be out of town on Election Day, trying to get more people out to vote. And it took 15 minutes just to fill out my ballot, about 20 minutes total to go through the whole process of getting the ballot and filling it out and everything. And that just is unacceptable. There's absolutely no reason that we should be spending 20 minutes at the polls filling out our ballots. And that's going to create longer wait lines. It's going to make it harder for people to vote. It's going to decrease the accessibility for voting. And I definitely changed my mind pretty much 2 minutes after voting, because that was absolutely obnoxious that I could have just pressed, you know, Democrat. I was voting for all the Democrats on the ballot anyways. And it's not because I didn't look up the candidates or that I wasn't educated on the candidates. I was fully educated on the candidates. It's just that the Democrats were the ones that I was choosing that I felt aligned like best with my values. So instead of just checking one box at the top and then being able to spend 5 minutes filling out the rest of the ballot, I had to go through and bubble every single person, which just seemed way too excessive.
Right. So a couple of things about that. So first of all, you mentioned about, you know, that you researched all the candidates and all that. And we did try to, by the way, get somebody who was in opposition. And just to tell you, they ended up not being in opposition after we had a short discussion about it. So that's why we don't have somebody in opposition here. Is that 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 that's uh, that's what happened, then they didn't want to come on. One of the objections that I hear from people is that well, you know, it encourages people to not do that kind of research. And I, what do you think about that? Is that a viable objection that, well, if we have this option, then some people won't do the research?
One of the things I like to do is try to figure out the motivation of the people that say, you know, in high-minded mm-hmm. principles, what is their real motivation? Mm-hmm. And so, in terms of, does it encourage people not to do some research? Yes, there's probably some grain of truth in that mm-hmm. that philosophy.
Sure.
However, as Kelly just mentioned, if you align philosophically with mm-hmm. the one party or another, mm-hmm. it could be the two major parties or it could be a minor mm-hmm. party, if you align philosophically mm-hmm. with a party, mm-hmm. and you don't know all the people that are running perhaps for Michigan Court of Appeals mm-hmm. or in other elections, the State Board of Education, mm-hmm. Then you have at least a little bit more to go on when mm-hmm. you have a party affiliation mm-hmm. because that gives you some information, mm-hmm. maybe not as much as preferable.
Sure.
But there are some people that I remember from political science class that take an extreme view, and mm-hmm. that is that it's good that people that don't have full information don't vote, mm-hmm. and because that only the people that are the elites that have all kinds of information should be the ones to vote. And then in one time back in our history, there was a literacy test before mm-hmm. people could vote. So I take the opposite view, that everyone has an inherent right and value as a citizen, and that because of that, everyone has an equal right to vote, whether mm-hmm. you're extremely wealthy or mm-hmm. extremely well-educated mm-hmm. or not. And the education process can be ongoing. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of this particular ballot proposal, it's very important to remember that it's not a requirement that you vote straight ticket. Mm-hmm. You definitely can vote for both parties. It's just an option. And another one of the reasons why that's an important option is because historically in the United States, and mm-hmm. maybe less so in Michigan, but not entirely, historically in urban areas, there have been longer lines simply because there haven't been enough polling stations. And whether that's by design or by accident, it doesn't matter.
Sure.
People have an intrinsic, inherent right and duty to vote. Mm-hmm. And to take that away from them, if they have to wait for 2 hours in line, for example, in mm-hmm. certain areas of the state, mm-hmm. simply because the ballots are too long, mm-hmm. that's not fair to the mm-hmm. people that have to wait mm-hmm. and probably have to leave before the 2 hours is up, if that ever is the case.
And we could eliminate some of those problems by actually having a week to vote, for example, or yeah. having a holiday, like a 2 or 3 day holiday, I would argue, for our voting. But there's also another objection that I want to make, a principled objection to this idea that straight ticket voting encourages people to not, you know, to not do as much research and so on. And that principled objection is that we shouldn't be telling people what their criteria for voting ought to be. You know, we shouldn't be telling people how they ought to prepare to vote. That's up to them.
Right.
Now, if we're concerned about their education in terms of the people running or the issues or any of that, then you know what we would do? We would fund education and we would say that literacy is a human right, and we wouldn't have courts, as recently was done, saying that the state doesn't have an obligation to provide good enough education that people can read, which is literally what the current Michigan administration has pushed through the courts, and the courts have agreed that Michigan doesn't have the obligation to provide that kind of education. So I think when you see conservatives who support the current legislature, the current governor, Bill Schuette, who was involved in that lawsuit, and they say that, well, we want people to be educated, sure, put your money where your mouth is. Otherwise, I don't believe that that's why you're doing it. I think you're doing it because you are trying to suppress people who don't agree with you and prevent them from voting. And I think you should be ashamed of that.
Agreed. And one thing that's significant to me historically, even when the Republicans had control of the Secretary of State's office, most of the Secretaries of State have been sympathetic to the idea that more people should vote. The process should be fair and accessible to everyone. But now you can look around the country and see in states like Georgia, Kansas, where we have two secretaries of state that are also running for governor at the same time.
Right, in Georgia and Kansas.
Georgia and Kansas. And they have those candidates have a vested interest in making sure they pick their voters.
Right.
Similar to Proposal 2, what they're trying to do. They're trying to restrict
similar to gerrymandering, which is what Proposal 2 is against.
Proposal 2 is trying to end gerrymandering, and that's a good thing, too.
Sure.
The same people that support Proposal 3, and I personally support Proposal 2 very strongly, because it takes away that right of the elected officials to pick their voters instead of the other way around.
Right.
So when there's voter suppression efforts, whether it's in other states right now, but in Michigan eventually, that's just wrong to try to suppress votes. If you look at Florida, there's a ballot issue in Florida right now that would reverse. They're one of four states now, I believe, that have prohibited people that have served time for a crime, minor or major. So that 1.5 million people in Florida cannot vote simply because of past incidents that occurred in their life. And that even if they've done
served
their time
and paved their debt to society,
exactly,
as people like to say,
paid their debt to society, those people currently in Florida cannot vote. That's an extreme situation where a state is purposely trying to restrict voting rights, and that's on the ballot now. Hopefully the citizens of Florida will change that and allow people that have served their time, paid their debt to society, to allow them to vote.
I by the way, I actually think that that's not far enough, because I think it's important to point out some of the hypocrisy at the core of our founding. So, for example, in the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson wrote in his justification for rebelling against the English crown, he wrote that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. Now, there isn't anybody more governed than somebody in prison. Okay. Now, of course, that sentiment, consent of the governed, did not make it into the Constitution. And not only did not make it into the federal constitution, didn't make it into any of the state constitutions of that generation or later generations, didn't make it into the Michigan Constitution when it was rewritten in 1963. And as a result, the founding generation, in their constitutions, multiple of them, federal and state, set up standards that in order to vote, you had to be white, male, wealthy, and own land. Our country was not designed, was not intended to be a democracy or a republic. It was intended to be an oligarchy of wealthy white male landowners. And the fact of the matter is that to a great extent, that system has created rule by wealthy white men. If you look at the statistics on it. Since we've had 50 states, since the founding, every 2 years we elected new legislatures, state and federal. If we just look at the last 60 years, so that people don't say, well, that was a long time ago. Let's just look at the last 60 years. The last 60 years, we're just coming up on another one, but up until now, there's been 29 different election cycles where we've seated 51 different legislatures, state and federal. 29 times 51 is 1,479 different legislatures that have been seated where not just the majority, but the supermajority was wealthy white men. Exactly the group that the founders wanted to maintain control over the country indefinitely. When we're talking about voter suppression, when we're talking about the structure of how the power of the vote gets translated through the machinery of government into policy, we've never been anything other than an oligarchy of wealthy white men. And right now, what we're trying to do in the footsteps of our forebears, as I mentioned in the introduction, is break that system and make it in and reformulate our government so that we actually have a democracy and a republic and not an oligarchy. And that's why I think that this proposal and many of the other voting rights proposals, including especially Proposal 2, anti-gerrymandering, is really important. We have to be aware of the history that we're coming from, and what we're trying to do is to make a real democracy out of this myth that we're supposed to have it. So
one of the other things that I wanted to bring up on the straight ticket side of things is I'm good friends with people that are very involved with Represent Us. And ranked choice voting is a huge issue for us. How will straight ticket being pushed into our constitution, how will that affect ranked choice voting in the future if we tried to implement ranked choice voting at the local, state, or federal level?
You might want to explain ranked choice voting a little bit because it's a newer concept, but...
Yeah. So with ranked choice voting, instead of just voting for one person, say you're voting for your city clerk, for example, and they're, well, city clerk's probably not a good example in Lansing, but say there's multiple parties for city that are running for city clerk. Mm-hmm. You can, instead of just choosing, you want to vote for the Democrat, you want to vote for the Republican or a third party, you can say, hi, I kind of like the Green Party candidate better than everybody else, so I'm going to put a one next to that person because that's my top choice. Mm-hmm. I want to rank the Democrat as my second choice, the Republican as my third, the Libertarian as my fourth, and an Independent as my fifth. And then the system actually figures out who... It's very difficult for me to explain. Do you understand that?
California actually has adopted that, I believe.
Yes, for local.
Yeah.
For
local elections, yeah.
And in some cases, you have a Democrat running against another Democrat because those are the two top vote getters. Mm-hmm. So in terms of allowing straight ticket voting, it could create some issues that need to be ironed out. The legislature can do that under this proposal because there are constitutional provisions and then implementation by statute. Mm-hmm. But the statute can't override the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So to allow for newer concepts like this to be effective, then it needs to be adjusted. So that's one of the things, too, in both Proposal 2 and Proposal 3 that I've heard as far as some of the opposition to it, is why is it so detailed, and especially particularly with Proposal 2. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things you've got to remember, though, is that both of these proposals, 2 and 3, are designed to take some power, not very, you know, in one particular area, which is voting, away from the legislature, legislators that have a vested interest in their own self-preservation. And so in order to do that and accomplish that, it has to be fairly specific in many respects, but not in every respect. And in terms of the straight ticket voting provision, there is room to flesh out the details in statute.
Okay, so then that actually, because it seems like if we have straight ticket voting and it's in our Constitution, that ranked choice voting wouldn't be able to work very well with that, because if it's constitutionally protected that straight ticket voting has to be a thing, how can we straight ticket vote with ranked choice voting?
Well, actually, there's a couple of ways that you can do it. One of the things is that as it is right now, if we had straight ticket voting like we used to have, up until the Republican legislature eliminated it. You could choose a particular party, okay, but then you could also split your ticket by, you know, choosing, you know, I want to choose everybody in this party, but where I go down and select somebody else, I'm splitting my ticket that way. And you don't have to do any, you can still mark the one up here, and then mark, you know, however many others and other in other parts in other columns, because it's party columns, you know, is the way that, So you'd choose the one that you want to devote most of your stuff in. Like, say, you know, say there's maybe 30 different positions that are partisan. You choose that, and then maybe there are 4 or 5 of them or 10 of them that you want to actually move over to a different party. So you choose the party that you want your most in, and then you choose the individuals that you want other places. And that's just, it's just an efficient way to fill out the ballot. is all that straight ticket voting is. Now, when you have ranked choice voting, one of the things that the way that you would do it is you would is you could check this the party bubble at the top. So that'd be the straight ticket for that party, and then you could go down to any of those places where there was where there was a ranked choice option, and go over to the next party that somebody else that you wanted. For that, the next person. So say for example, for you, the Democrats might be your first choice, and then maybe the Greens would be your second choice. So you just go down to that row, go over to the green column, and write a number two, and
right.
your ranked choice at the from the first would just be for the Democratic column. So that you could do it that way. It's not that difficult. You just have to say, okay, if I'm voting that way, then my first choice is in the Democratic column, and then I fill in my other choices. And if my first choice isn't in the Democratic column, just like regular straight ticket voting that we had, as you said, was it 127 years? You said.
Yep.
You go over and mark a one in maybe in the Republican column if you like that person better for that particular office. And then that changes that to that being the rank choice, the first rank in the choices. So that's, I don't think that's a big deal. It's it takes an extra sentence to explain, basically.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does, and yeah. I'd like to move on to a little bit slightly different issue in this whole area,
mm-hmm.
and that is what I've heard as some criticism of these proposals to expand voting rights,
mm-hmm.
and being that. Well, if you do that, then there's all kinds of fraud that's going to result. there was a study done by a Loyola Law School professor, mm-hmm. Justin Levitt, who looked at all the elections, state, national, and local, between the year 2000 and the year 2014. So you've got
like a billion votes, I think this one has.
Absolutely.
Yes.
A billion votes altogether were cast in
right.
this time period this study was undertaken. And
mm-hmm.
as far as credible evidence of actual voter fraud impersonating
mm-hmm.
somebody else
right.
and then voting twice,
right.
there were only 31 instances of
mm-hmm.
that documented.
Wow. Right.
And
was that 14 years or 13 years?
14 years.
14 years, yeah.
And so in those elections, only 31 credible instances of
right.
actual impersonation of
right.
somebody else,
mm-hmm.
which is
billion.
All the fear, that's the, mm-hmm. the statement that, this is going to be terrible because you're never
right.
going to figure out who is who. Well, truly, it's extremely difficult to impersonate somebody without getting caught. In contrast,
mm-hmm.
the number of people that were actually denied the right to vote
mm-hmm.
over the years, this just pales in comparison as a problem to that in terms of voter suppression and
mm-hmm.
the effectiveness of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can say that you're trying to protect accuracy,
mm-hmm.
but what you're really doing is restricting the rights of voters to actually vote in practice.
Right. No, absolutely. The other thing is that you have, vast numbers of people that are denied the right to vote through a number of different means, and even further, even people who get the right to vote don't actually get any significant representation for a lot of the structural reasons, that we talked about in the Prop 2 podcast last week. But we'll probably get to some of those here as well. So I absolutely agree. The voter fraud objection is patently absurd. It's just the data does not support it. It's purely magical thinking on the part of people who want to use this as a fear tactic to prevent people that will not vote for them, most likely, from voting.
Mm-hmm.
These people don't believe in democracy. They don't want there to be a democracy. They're constitutional originalists. And under the original Constitution, we have a plutocratic oligarchy that's ruled by the wealthy. So we need to be careful about these people making these claims and call them out on it whenever possible.
Yes, and to be fair, the Democrats, when they had control of the legislature, they would gerrymander too.
Absolutely.
I don't know of any attempts to suppress voting
mm-hmm.
at all. Which is a kind of a new phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
newer phenomenon
mm-hmm.
Nationally.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Voting Rights Act took care, for a while, of a number of attempts to suppress the vote.
Yeah.
But in a 2013 case, Shelby County versus Holder, mm-hmm. the U.S. Supreme Court restricted the impact yep. of the Voting Rights Act mm-hmm. to say that the pre-approval process, which for states that historically had yep. Had taken away the yep. the right to vote for people, that was right. no longer in effect. Right. So since 2013, it's mm-hmm. opened up the door to some states, yep. and Michigan should not be one of those states, open up the door to round two of voter suppression.
Round two of Jim Crow. Let's be
exactly.
accurate. This is what we're talking about, is Jim Crow. And it's not just Jim Crow. It's Jim Crow kinds of laws against the poor, and doubly against minorities who are more likely to be poor.
Yes.
It is both parties. I mean, I joined the Democratic Party just in 2016, after the election, I was astounded that there are lawyers in the Democratic Party that hold positions, for example, parliamentarian, who don't understand, for example, cumulative voting, mm-hmm. which is a voting system that is explicitly one of the key voting systems that the federal courts use to enforce the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Right. I was participating in a Democratic Party election where they said they were going to use cumulative voting and then used plurality winner first past the post voting and claimed that that was the same thing, which is exactly what cumulative voting is designed to alleviate the problems of.
Right.
You know, and these are people that are, you know, leaders in the Democratic Party that don't understand not only their own bylaws, but the actual, you know, cumulative voting used to enforce the 1965 Voting Rights Act. I'm sorry, that just still blows my mind to this day.
Just a little bit bitter stuff.
I'm not bitter about it. It's really, there's a lot of people that would say that to me, but it's not about being bitter. It's about being surprised that, you know, people aren't paying at least that much attention, especially people that are, you know, in positions of authority within the party that are supposed to know better.
So these restrictions on the process to make mm-hmm. sure they're fair right. would apply to both parties.
Yeah, and absolutely.
The last one that I mentioned calls for an audit of the elections in case of any kind of alleged faulty roll.
Right.
And so there is built into promote the vote proposal 3 mm-hmm. the provision for accuracy mm-hmm. and fairness mm-hmm. in making sure that the elections are conducted
right.
properly.
Right. Let me just ask about that, because there's a big problem. I'm trying to remember the exact wording. I should have made a note of it. But there's a provision currently in Michigan law that actually ends up preventing recounts. Not because of the inability to recount, but because of some technicalities about how certain things are handled.
I've been involved in recounts before,
sure.
and to me that makes absolutely zero sense.
Right.
And so that should be addressed by the courts, and hopefully the Proposal 3 will give enough ammunition to make sure that is ruled unconstitutional as well.
Right. Okay. So basically the way that Prop 3 would solve that, if I've understood what you're saying correctly, is by creating a standard that says you have to have this kind of an ability to recount.
Right.
And if you have a statute, which is what we're...
audit, which is not actually defined in the Constitution. Again,
right.
you have to leave some things back to be implemented
right.
by statute. So as part of that definition standard, there needs to be a change in the law that...
Right.
That really makes it impossible to have an effective recount under current law.
Right.
One of the things that I was wondering about is, so it takes a lot of effort to do a statewide ballot initiative. Can you give some rundown so everyone knows how much effort it took, how many volunteers you might
yeah.
have had, and how long you had to, like the time frame you had to do that, what kind of effort that took, and if you're going to use that momentum to go for another round of a ballot initiative, and what's that going to look like in the future?
Well, it's hard to predict what's going to happen in terms of other ballot initiatives, because we don't know exactly what the people that want to suppress the votes are going to try to do. there may well be a time when another ballot initiative is necessary. But we started in early April on Promote the Vote and turned in the signatures in August, I believe it was. Needed 415,000 valid signatures. We collected more than that, but the process itself was very time-consuming. And in this case, we had all kinds of volunteers, and I was one of those. We also had some paid circulators that helped to get the issue on the ballot. So in terms of the proposal, too, it was almost all volunteers.
Yeah.
And that's an extremely impressive effort on the part of many, many people. Mm-hmm. Some of the same volunteers that were utilized in proposal two are helping in proposal three and vice versa. So they're, you know, because they're basically both trying to increase the fairness in the electoral system.
Right.
That's awesome. Awesome. Really cool. I'm hoping that after all of this that a lot of those volunteers from Prop 2 and 3 are going to get involved with the ranked choice voting effort. I think that that is going to be a huge thing that will benefit our democracy, because I think right now with the comfortability of our two-party system that we need to shake things up a little bit and make sure that our representatives actually realize that they have to represent us, and that it doesn't matter what their donors look like. If we can rank our votes and don't feel like we're going to be throwing them away, that they could actually lose their position of power to someone that will represent us.
So. When I served on the legislative staff, it was almost all male. There were a few women. But, you know, when you think about it, it's only been a little over 100 years that women have had the right to vote. And it's been
only a little over 100 years since we've had the right to directly elect senators, too.
Yeah. So, you know, step by step, you know, there's an old maxim that say you start where the client is. You start where the system is.
Right.
And you're right. There are a lot of things that need to be changed in our system. But these are real positive changes that are going to increase the fairness, the fundamental fairness, regardless of which party is affected by the people that would want to restrict the vote to just some elites.
Right.
This would make it very difficult to do that in Michigan. They're probably going to need going to be repeated steps that will be taken in Michigan, but this will put Michigan in the forefront. Many years ago, 50 years ago or so, Michigan was in the forefront of voter rights, and we had the motor voter statute, which became federal law, and Michigan was the first state to adopt that. But we have lag behind other states, and there are a number of provisions in this Promote the Vote initiative that other states have already adopted. Michigan has not. So we're getting back up to speed, just up to where other states are right now.
Sure.
But this will be very significant, Proposal 2 and Proposal 3.
Right.
Now, the chances of passage, some people have been asking about that, and there have been some recent polling data on that that you're probably familiar with, even just today, that was announced.
Yeah, so the polling that just came out, actually, there's an article in the Free Press, I think you might be referring to. It shows Prop 3 is the least controversial of all the of the three proposals, with something like 69%. I'm looking at it right here. The chart looks like it's 69% in favor and about 25, maybe 26% against, according to this chart here. Whereas you know, the others are, you know, at 59 or right around 60%. So it's about 10 points more popular and has much less opposition than either of the other two proposals. So I mean, I think it's pretty clear to most people that this is all about improving access to the ballot in a fair way and taking power away from those people who might try to prevent that. So.
Agreed. And in terms of fairness, it's true that a lot of these points in this proposal are current law.
Right.
But that doesn't mean they'll stay current law, because what this does is, again, it basically puts it in the Constitution that these rights cannot be taken away. But because of that, too, because they're not radical, they're really apple pie things that everyone can get behind.
Right.
As far as I know, there's not organized opposition, and at least a lot of no organized group has come out against it, because this is something that's needed to make sure that we have fair, free elections, and that there's accountability within the system.
Right. And by the way, I would still love talking to anybody out there who's actually has a significant opposition to this. I would be more than happy to have you on our next show and see what you have to say about it. But I don't really think I have yet to find an idea in opposition to this that makes the least bit of sense.
Agreed.
Yeah. So so for me, part of the next question is, you know, as we've mentioned in various different forms, this is one step in a much longer process that predates us, you know, that our forefathers our forebears have fought to make our system more democratic and more representative of the people, this is a step further in that direction, but it's still just one step. There are lots of other steps we could take. What do you think are some of the next steps that we need to be looking at to improve, to transform what was designed as a plutocratic oligarchy into a democracy or a democratic republic? What do you think some of the next things related to voting, and in this case, since we're talking about Prop 3 and some of the other voting changes?
One of the things we need to do is watch what happens nationally on some of these proposals to restrict voting,
mm-hmm.
because if some of those do get enacted, mm-hmm. or held constitutional, then Michigan is going to be at risk, depending mm-hmm. on the makeup of the legislature.
Sure.
So we need to be vigilant. Another thing, just going back one step too,
sure.
even though the polling data looks good, mm-hmm. it's no reason. There is absolutely no reason to give up the intense effort to get
sure.
this approved, because people do need to know that it is important to make sure mm-hmm. that our rights are preserved.
Right.
And same thing with the rest of the things on the ballot. We have candidates that could go one way or the other.
Sure.
We have Supreme Court candidates.
Right.
And to have those people fairly looking at constitutional
right.
provisions is extremely important as well.
Right. Especially since, you know, like you said, necessarily when you write a constitutional amendment, you have to leave some room for implementation,
right.
because the implementation gets into details that require that requires a more hands-on approach to making sure that that we work out any of the issues.
Yeah.
And then as a result, there's going to be challenges in front of the Michigan Supreme Court, because this is a change to the Michigan Constitution. So I've made a shout out on this show before. I'll do it again for Sam Bagenstos and Megan Kavanaugh, who are running for the Michigan Supreme Court right now. It's an opportunity to flip the court from 5-2 in favor of some very, very conservative people on the court to 4-3 in favor of a more liberal, progressive court that will look at voting rights not as a constitutional originalist, where if you're a constitutional originalist, you have all of these restrictions to voting. Right now in the U.S. Constitution, there isn't an outright right to vote. There's a prohibition on what you can and can't use to prevent people from voting. Mm-hmm. But that leaves open a whole wide range of stuff, which is one of the things that Prop 3 is here to address. So.
Yeah. Some of the stuff that we were talking about off screen was the natives and was it North Dakota?
Native Americans in North Dakota.
Yeah.
Disenfranchised by the Supreme Court just recently, right?
Mm-hmm.
For not having the right address, the right kind of address.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you know more about that detail?
Well, basically, the way the ruling in North Dakota just recently came out was that Native Americans had to have the street address on their voter registration.
Mm-hmm.
And historically, Native Americans have not had street addresses. So
mm-hmm.
this is another creative attempt
mm-hmm.
to try to disenfranchise people.
Right.
So there are efforts to certify the Native Americans in the particular areas when they're voting.
Sure.
But there's a lot of doubt as to whether that's going to be effective or not.
Sure.
And so one of the things philosophically, historically, over the last 40 years,
mm-hmm.
The Koch brothers, who used to be affiliated with the John Birch Society,
yep.
Have funded to the tunes of hundreds of millions of dollars
yep.
think tanks around the country
mm-hmm.
to perfect messages that would basically restrict voting rights and to
sure.
Get their particular elitist type view across.
Sure.
And that was heightened, if you look at the book Dark Money by Jane Mayer.
Mm-hmm.
Jane Mayer describes an incident on the same day that President Obama was inaugurated.
Mm-hmm.
There was a meeting of billionaires in Palm Desert, California, to try to strategize how to restrict voting. And principally that was on the redistricting process and to promote gerrymandering, which all happened since in the last few years. They were actually successful in the, after the 2010 census to get gerrymandering even more scary, more
More less, unequal.
More unequal than in the past. And so that has been an effort that some of these initiatives, especially Proposal 2, have been trying to address. But what we have to do is be vigilant and make sure that the decision makers aren't influenced by undue amounts of money in the political process, which is what has happened over the last 40 years, but particularly in the, inside the last 10 years.
Right.
Yeah, one of the things that I was going to bring up with the address situation, I lived in Bath, so just about 20 minutes from here, lived right on Main Street, but for some reason they wouldn't give us mailboxes. So we all had to have P.O. boxes and get all of our address and our mail and everything with our P.O. box. So if that would have restricted me from the right to vote, that would have been a problem, and it would have been a problem for all of the people on that street, and I can tell you it's because they're white, and that would have made a difference, and we would change laws based on that, in my opinion. So I think that it's important that we have people that are on the court that actually are going to uphold the rights to vote for all of us, not just, you know, the few wealthy elite.
Well, so, I mean, I think that right now we're in a situation where we have every day, pretty much on TV, radio, print media, everywhere, we hear about these attacks on our democratic institutions, attacks on our democratic government, et cetera. And what people don't seem to realize is that what's really being attacked is the norms that a culture that have grown up around our government as our culture has moved on from where the founders were. Okay. And what's happened is, for example, people get angry at Mitch McConnell because he didn't give Merrick Garland a hearing. Well, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that he has to. The only reason that there's any sense that he ought to have is because we have a cultural idea that we're supposed to be a democracy and we're supposed to be fair. And when he's not fair, then people get upset about that. But the fact of the matter is that we have rules and laws to create public trust in our systems and institutions. And the systems and institutions that our founders designed and created are not designed to create broad public trust. They're designed to create public trust among the wealthy elites who they were designed to put into power. And who have been kept in power by those systems, as I described, you know, when we talked about the statistics a little bit ago. So what we're talking about here is we're talking about our current culture, where we've gotten to in terms of how our beliefs about fairness and equality and what it means to have a democracy and to have the right to vote. Those are all things that have changed culturally over the past 242 years, but we haven't made those changes in law. And that's one of the things that we're really struggling with right now. And we need to recognize not to look at our existing institutions and say, well, that's, you know, we're having attacks on democracy. What we're having attacks on is our sense of how they're supposed to work, not how they're actually designed.
Yeah, and some of those attacks are some things that the states are not going to be best suited to handle.
Right.
For example, we've had documented evidence that the foreign countries have hacked into our electoral process, but they've also tried to influence elections on social media, which is even more nefarious and more difficult to police. So because those protections weren't built in when Facebook and Twitter became predominant methods of communication. Mm-hmm. Now we're going trying to go back and fix that. Mm-hmm. But those kinds of things are going to need to be handled at the federal level, mm-hmm. Because Michigan alone isn't going to be able to address those issues. They go well beyond our state boundaries. But the methods of trying to spread untruthful information and to try to distort our electoral process, those we've got to watch very carefully to make mm-hmm. sure that those attempts to influence our election process are addressed strongly and fairly for everyone's benefit for mm-hmm. our continued form of government.
Right. Thoughts?
It's interesting that you bring up, foreign affairs or foreign entities interfering in our elections, because I think that if we had paid more attention and cared more about dark money in politics and done more to prevent, untrue information being pushed out the way that it is, then we never would have even had that as a problem in the first place, because that would never have gotten there. So the way that our systems are set up to allow people to blatantly lie. I mean, I watched the part of the gubernatorial debate in Michigan the other day, and nobody's calling people out for lying. Watching the gubernatorial debate in Florida, that racist that's running against Gillum just blatantly lying to an entire crowd and everyone watching at home is just obnoxious and insane to me. And it surprises me that more people aren't up in arms and doing more. And I feel like Republicans have no qualms with dark money, and I feel like Democrats are just like, well, we have to, instead of doing more to fight that. And
it is a challenge with the First Amendment protections for free speech. And it used to be in the old days that they would say that the cure for bad speech is good speech, more speech.
Yeah.
But the dynamics have changed since social media has become so pervasive, and it made it very easy for even domestic actors to manipulate the system. Because it's basically going back to what's in people's brains. If they have really distorted information, untrue information that can't be countered by more speech, then we've got to figure out how to curtail some of that and still have the viable First Amendment rights.
Well, I think that the problem isn't that good speech is at a disadvantage against false speech. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think what's happened is that we have a Supreme Court that's decided that money is equal to speech.
Yeah, that's very true.
That's the key problem, and the ridiculousness of that is that actually money is a social construct. Every single dollar that exists in the U.S. economy was originally spent by the U.S. government. Okay, literally, that's the U.S. government is literally the only entity that's empowered to create money. So that's just that's just definitionally true. And the U.S. government is, if we believe that we're a democracy or a democratic republic, or that we should be, then the U.S. government belongs to us. And just like the roads and the bridges are public infrastructure, so is money. So the idea that money is speech would be equivalent to the road is speech. I get to do anything that I want on the road. It doesn't matter how big my car is, how much it weighs, how much tonnage I put on my truck, anything like that. That's ridiculous, because we know that when you use a road like that, you damage it and destroy its public utility. And we've all paid for that public utility. And exactly the same thing is true of actual money. That's where it comes from.
We need to regulate money in the political process.
Absolutely.
In a fair way. And Citizens United, that decision of the U.S. Supreme Court really restricted some of that. But that's, again, why it's so important to have fair-minded justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. We need to have, and if, barring that, we need some U.S. constitutional amendments to take charge mm-hmm. of the situation that is really out of control right now.
Right, right. I agree.
100% agree. I'd like to see, I mean, honestly, beyond ranked choice voting that I mentioned earlier, I'd like to see a lot of the people that have gotten into this movement, that I hope it's a movement, with Prop 2 and Prop 3 getting involved and trying to reverse mm-hmm. our Citizens United on steroids bill that went through this last year in the Michigan legislature, and SB 571 that was another very detrimental bill that went against Michiganders and the ability to actually help or be able to actually have that free speech that isn't controlled by the money.
I don't remember the number. What was that?
SB 571. That happened about 2 or 3 years ago.
And what did it do?
And that basically was a Michigan extension of the Citizens United.
Okay. Do you know the details?
No, I used to work for the legislature, but I haven't been around that process for a little while now, so mm-hmm. I'll have to catch up to speed.
I'll have to look that up and
yeah,
find
I don't
out.
Have the
I'll
full information
talk.
Right now. I just remember the feeling I felt when I went through.
Sure.
It was infuriating. That's actually the reason I got involved in politics in the first place, was to get money out of politics, because it's absolutely ridiculous and unfair that we can't have, like, we can't actually have the same ability to influence our peers as those with money.
Right. You know, the fact that you were upset about that process, and you know, that is one heartening thing in the last couple of years, to see the amount of citizen involvement in these two ballot proposals mm-hmm. and also things like the Women's March mm-hmm. and the door-to-door efforts of a lot of people that are concerned about preserving our and enhancing our democratic process, mm-hmm. Where, you know, the ends have to be legitimate, but the means of getting there have to be legitimate too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So to have a fair process is what we're really talking about.
Sure.
In enhancing our democratic process, and with a small d, to be fair to everybody in our state, regardless of party, regardless of race, creed, sexual orientation, we need fairness in our system, and we need to be on guard for any group or political initiative that tries to take rights away. These are designed to give the citizens more rights and to make sure that the process itself is more sane and fair to everyone involved.
Great. So I completely agree with what you've just said there. I wish that we had the opposition, but every opposition person that I've talked to has ended up not being in opposition. So everybody get out there and vote for Prop 3. I would also say Prop 2 and Prop 1. Take a little break and then come back and maybe clear up a couple of things or talk about some other interesting stuff. Okay, so we were just talking a minute ago about SB 571 you had brought up.
Yep.
So I think over
Citizens
the break
United
you pulled. And Citizens
on
United
steroids,
and steroids. Okay.
Which is a current law in Michigan that just came up in the last year or so. Mm-hmm. What this does is not only does Michigan law allows candidates to, this is from the Intercept mm-hmm. article about it, is mm-hmm. this not only does the new Michigan law allow candidates to rake in unlimited amounts of money for super PACs, eschewing the meager federal limit, it also allows candidates, consultants, vendors, and attorneys to simultaneously work for a super PAC so long as that person doesn't pass strategic information between the two. But as this says, that's not exactly practical, since political consultants or ad buyers can't simply forget what they know about campaign internal strategies. So this is completely giving a leg up to super PACs and wealthy donors in comparison to what we had before, which actually had limitations and mm-hmm. restrictions on super PACs working with candidates.
Right. And that was SB 571?
No, that was the Citizens United on steroids that just came out in the last year.
Right.
So this is really the first big election cycle that's been implemented
right.
in. With SB 571, that prohibits public bodies like libraries, Secretary of State staff from distributing information about ballot proposals 60 days before the election. It also eliminated the February filing deadline for independent and political committees, and reestablishment of the requirements to file an annual report covering the period from October 21st through December 31st. And it also effectively doubles the amount of money PACs can donate to candidates for the second time in 2 years, which has, in effect, quadrupled the limit since 2013 with the different laws that have passed in between then. It also prohibits corporations from collecting contributions from its employees to a union's PAC. So taking rights away from unions more than we've already done in the past. I specifically remember SB 571 because I was working with a group called Wolf Pack, which is a super PAC to, it's basically a suicide super PAC. It's a super PAC to destroy all super PACs, created by Cenk Uygur from the Young Turks. And when I found out about SB 571, I was just getting to California during the presidential primaries. And I was helping a friend out there, and I called the governor's office, and I asked the lady at the governor's office, I said, please, can you do me a favor? And she said, what do you need? I said, can you go into the governor's office and take every pen out of his office? And she's like, what do you mean? I was like, do not let him sign this bill. Do not do it for the future of democracy in Michigan. Do not let him sign this bill. She thought I was crazy, but I was serious.
Sure. So it's just, it's another way of super PACs to get more money. You know, into the same candidates, The whole idea that who gets elected should have anything to do with how much money they can raise, I think is just as antithetical to democracy as you can get.
Absolutely.
Well, you wanted to talk some more about how our current system works and ideas of democracy.
Yeah, we started out talking about fairness and due process, and that fair play is really important if we're going to have any semblance of a democratic system. Our democracy requires that we have fair voting, and that's really one of the linchpins of a whole process. Mm-hmm. If people cannot vote, their vote isn't counted, if money in the political process is paramount, and thoughtful decision making by voters isn't the most important thing. We really need to make sure that we have a fair process. That's number one. We also need to make sure that citizens know that their vote is extremely important. When you look at voting figures of younger people, traditionally, over a long span of time, younger people haven't had the voting participation as older people. And really, in talking with college students and high school students and people that are just now getting to be voting age, they need to know the important part of our system of government is voting. And that without that, we're going to drift toward an autocracy. It's not guaranteed that the United States will have the kind of public participation we've had in the past, even. So we really need to make sure that young people and people who don't think their vote is important, to make sure that they do realize the direct connection between their vote and public policy. Because if they don't vote, that means that the other people that that may not have their best interests at heart are going to carry the day. We really need to have the participation levels up to a high amount to make sure that our system of government is preserved and protected. We especially is true when we have the redistricting coming up after the census in 2020. Right. The legislature and the system that will be in place then is going to determine what for the next 10 years what it's going to be like as far as redistricting and making sure that we have these protections in place in Proposal 2 and in Proposal 3 are critical for the next decade, more than next decade, for Michigan residents.
So I I think that's absolutely true. I think that the problem with getting more voter participation, one of the key reasons that we have low voter participation is because the impact that your vote has is relatively small, and over the years it's actually gotten smaller. So a lot of people don't get how big the difference is.
What really grinds me too, Leo, is the idea that was floated out there, especially before the last election, that, hey, to certain groups, your vote doesn't count. Mm-hmm. Your vote doesn't count, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But the opposite is true. If you look at the highest levels of our government, mm-hmm. and we see the drift toward autocracy, a drift toward a very few people can control mm-hmm. what's best for everybody.
Let's be clear. This is the way that the Constitution is set up when, for example, the way that the Senate works. You know, you have a situation where, for example, Wyoming, the least populous state, gets two senators. Michigan gets two senators. That means that you and I and everybody else in Michigan are vastly underrepresented in the U.S. Senate. Now, people will say, well, but all of the states are equal. Well, why does a piece of land have an influence on what policies are that govern people? Okay, this is supposed to be a democracy, where demos means people. It's not a convention of landowners. Oh wait, it was designed as a convention of landowners.
Not to mention, if you look at the way that our Supreme Court justices are confirmed, that doesn't go through the House anyways.
Right.
So, putting it through the Senate doesn't actually give the representation and the votes that should be used to decide who is going to have a life term on the Supreme Court.
Right. So if you go by population, I've done these numbers, by the way. At some point, I'll put them up on our website. I've got the spreadsheets done. I just got to make it look pretty. But if you look at the numbers, if you say that if you believe that what democracy means is you get one person, one vote, which is what actually the Supreme Court has said it's supposed to be, okay, and that only makes sense if you also say and everybody's vote has an equal influence on the policies of the government, because that's what the whole point is, right? Is to have an equal influence on the policy of the government. So if we look at the numbers there. Again, Wyoming being the smallest, the lowest population state, they have just under 600,000 people. If you take their population and divide it into the population of Michigan, their population gets one representative in the U.S. House. If you take their population divided into Michigan's population, we should have 16 House reps. We have 14. That's being underrepresented by 14%. Okay, so if you do that with every state, you find out that 34 of the 50 states are underrepresented by 10% or more, 24 of them are underrepresented by 20% or more, and 3 of them are underrepresented by 30% or more.
Yeah, California and New York.
Well, California is underrepresented by 26%. I was just looking at this earlier. They have 53 House reps. If everybody in California had equal representation with everybody in Wyoming, they would have 67.
But you're talking about the Senate as well, and there's no question that that's true. That's not a democratic feature of our Constitution. Was simply a compromise to get the big states and the small states to ratify.
Well, it was. Let's be clear. It wasn't about the big states and the small states. It was about the slave-owning states who wanted to make sure that they didn't that people that didn't own slaves and thought that owning slaves was wrong would vote them out of their property.
Right.
Which they were considered human beings.
Clearly right that there's imperfections in our system, and basically inherent, baked into our system.
Designed into our system. Yeah. It's not an accident.
No question. And what we need to do is, say, what is the art of the possible? Mm-hmm. What can we do? What positive steps can we mm-hmm. take to make sure that fairness moving forward? Mm-hmm. And it's not going to be a one-off type thing that's going to solve
that's
everything.
That's right.
We're going to have to keep moving forward in the direction of greater participation in the system. And
but my point is that greater participation isn't going to be enough until we change some of those structural features that that intentionally underrepresent people. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at, you know, so I say that I say that California is underrepresented by 26% in the U.S. House. If you look, they're underrepresented in the Senate by 97%.
Sure.
And if you combine that into the Electoral College, they're underrepresented in the Electoral College by 58%. Michigan, by the way, is underrepresented in the Electoral College by 50% exactly.
To me, there's no reason why we need the Electoral College any longer whatsoever.
Yeah. Right.
You look at the election of 2000 and the most recent election.
Sure.
A majority of the people, or at least a plurality of the people, wanted one candidate, and mm-hmm. we actually ended up with somebody
right.
else.
Now, and you notice, by the way, that it's exactly the kind of thing that the founders designed the Electoral College to do. The only power the Electoral College has is to overturn the will of the people.
Yeah.
That tells you right there that the founders were not interested in the will of the people.
Of course, for some of these things, it's going to take a U.S. constitutional amendment.
Absolutely.
And that it's not easy to do by design.
Sure.
And that may well be part of what should be done in the future. There's mm-hmm. no question about it. And there are other things that we could, you know, think of that would be in the mm-hmm. steps of a more perfect union, as
sure.
they say.
Right. Absolutely.
But right now, we've got some things we can do as mm-hmm. very practical steps mm-hmm. to enhance the process in Michigan
sure.
and in other states right now, too. We need to make sure that people are aware of what's going on
right.
in the U.S. Congress, in the state legislature, and with our administration and the Supreme Court.
Right.
It's that awareness that I'm very hopeful will carry forward and be enhanced by mm-hmm. The intense level of participation mm-hmm. we've had, again, by a number of groups and women and sure. the participation in the groups that you're affiliated with. Those are all important steps to make sure we get a better system for our kids and our grandkids.
Absolutely. I'm sorry, did you have something?
I think that Promote the Vote and Prop 2 and other things that we've been talking about are all going to enhance the democratic system. And we have seen an uptick of participation, especially participation outside of voting, which is extremely important. I think voting is like bare bones, bare minimum that we should all be doing. But there's so many people that don't vote. There's so many people that don't believe that their vote counts. They don't mm-hmm. think that it matters, and it doesn't matter who is elected. They're all corrupt anyways, or, you know, we've all heard the millions of reasons people don't vote. How do you think we can reach those people? How do you think that we can get to those people and say, these are the things that we're changing, or try to get them out in any way that we haven't been doing so far?
It's a slow process, and you pointed out that just in the conversation you had within the last 24 hours
mm-hmm.
that you are able to get somebody to take a fresh perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that those one-on-one conversations, I think, where it's really at. And when I had the opportunity to serve on the staff of the legislature, I got to know a number of legislators up close and personal, and I do know that there are some very caring people, and I can think of people on both sides of the aisle. And one specific example was a state House of Representatives member, a Republican by the name of Vern Ehlers. And at one point, I was also an advocate. And I asked Representative Ehlers, he later became a senator and a U.S. Congressman, he's also had a PhD in physics from UCal Berkeley, so he's extremely bright. I asked him if I could count on his support for a measure, and he says, I don't know. I want to listen to the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that was the perfect statement to say, okay, look at both sides of the issue before you make a decision. Look at the pros and cons of the candidates. And yes, if you really don't know anything about the political process and you choose not to vote, fine. But really what we need to do is get more informed people in the system and more informed legislators in the system and congresspeople, because to take a look at both sides of the issue carefully and to really understand in depth and not just use social media as your source of information, as some politicians seem to want to do. I think it's not ever going to be a perfect system, but we can definitely demand that our elected officials are aware of things and listen to us, because if they don't, they should be voted out of office.
Right. So I wanted. There was one thing that you said. I agree with everything that you said there. I think that those are all really, really important points to move. But I think that you used a phrase that actually I think goes back to Otto von Bismarck. Politics is the art of the possible. Is that okay? Yeah. I've seen it attributed to Cuomo, but I actually think it goes back to Bismarck.
Oh yeah, it goes long way back.
Long way back. And that's actually I think that something that's different about progressive politics versus establishment politics. I think establishment politics is absolutely politics is the art of the possible. Mm-hmm. Don't try to get me to do more than I think that I can do. I mean, that was that was the argument that we were having about between Whitmer and Abdul about healthcare. Mm-hmm. The thing is that if politics is always just the art of the possible, then you never change what's possible.
Well, you need both. You need the progressive, you need forces to say, okay, here's what we need to do. Mm-hmm. And eventually a lot of that philosophy gets ingrained. I remember back when the environmental movement was popular with both parties.
Sure.
And
the good old days.
Yeah, President Nixon actually was helpful in getting the Clean Air Act. So it starts maybe with an impossible push. I think Senator Sanders has actually made what looked to be impossible much more so in terms of health insurance.
I just want to say, so that's exactly, I think that progressive politics says that politics is the art of changing the possible.
And that's good.
That's what we have to push is that it's not acceptable anymore to just say that politics is the art of the possible. We have to say is politics is the art of changing the possible by changing people's minds. Like you said, just in the last 24 hours, I experienced that, and you experienced that all over the country right now. And part of what Sanders did, to your point about about how he changed what's possible in medical care, is that he came out and said, I'm a democratic socialist. Basically he's saying that he's basically FDR. I mean, in terms of his policies. But what he did was he got a lot of people all across the country who have been privately in their little groups or by themselves thinking, you know what, there's this other way that I've read about and I've learned about that. And when Sanders started being on the front page saying, I'm a democratic socialist, healthcare is a human right, a lot of these people stood up and looked around and said, hey, there's a whole bunch of us here.
Yeah. That's an extremely important function. Mm-hmm. It's rare that you find both a pathfinder and a consensus builder in the same in the same person. Mm-hmm. I work a little bit with former speaker Bill Ryan, who was that type of person who was both a consensus builder and a pathfinder. He was an effective advocate for new ventures, new pathways, but he was also able to get the votes to get something through and work across party lines. Mm-hmm. So we need both types of people in our system in order to get real change.
Sure. I absolutely agree, but I think that I think that it's important to be clear about which one of those kinds of people we need to have out there as top line leaders that are on television and in the newspaper and all of that kind of stuff. And the people that we need there are the trailblazers. Not the people who are going to say politics is the art of the possible, but the people that are going to say politics is the art of changing the possible. Politics is we're going to make this argument and we're going to work hard to show people why this is a better way than that way.
And you also need to work across party lines in order to get those magic number of votes as an even number plus one. You need a majority in order to get a bill over to the governor. So there is an art form, and I think that's an extremely invaluable part of the puzzle too.
Absolutely.
I think one big part of that is that it's one thing that I saw with specifically Senator Sanders is that he didn't just motivate people to get involved and say, let's work towards what we've always been told is impossible, what we've always been told is radical and crazy. He said, let's fight for these things together. And he got people motivated to work together on that. And so I went from a voter to an activist. I went from just a voter to an activist in, you know, the matter of basically 5 minutes because of listening to him. And my mom went from a non-voter to a voter in the matter of watching a VFW video for 20 minutes, like congratulating Bernie Sanders. But I think that that step up, everybody made like their own step up. And I think that if we continue to have leaders like that, that maybe, you know, one day I'll run for office again and actually be able to make change in that way. And my mom will turn into the activist and, you know, somebody else will go from voter to, or non-voter to a voter.
So, no, I think that's exactly the thing, is that you have to have a message about how we're going to make the future better than the present. And that will encourage more people to vote. But we also, but on top of that, we need to change some of the structural things that we've discussed. I'm sorry, go ahead.
And we also need to make sure that we're effective in delivering the message. One of the best examples that I've seen ever seen of that was Phil Hart when he he gave a talk about he compared the electorate, he compared the U.S. Senate to a family, and he came out in favor of one candidate for president. He says, you know, when a leader of a family has to make a decision, you look at more than one variable, and the more that people that want to seek change are effective at talking about values and translating those into understandable bite-sized chunks to move their colleagues and move the electorate, the better we can translate these good ideas into public policy.
Absolutely, and I think, and I think the fact of the matter is, I think that the left has the better values argument. I mean, I don't think there's any question about that. The problem is that one of those values is that we don't try to impose our values on others. Okay, you know, so we're more on the left. We're much more likely to say, let's talk about this. Let's try to let's try to have a discussion rather than I have the power to make this happen. And therefore, I'm just going to do it. I mean, that's what McConnell did when we talked about, you know, Kavanaugh earlier, and with Merrick Garland. That's what gets Republicans in power in trouble a lot more than Democrats in power.
When you say when you hear a politician say, like we've heard before, that the reason I'm doing something is because I can. That should scare the heck out of people.
Absolutely.
Because really, what they should be thinking about is what's best for the people.
Absolutely.
And when they do that, then they can't stray too far awry. But when they say, I have the power because, you know, and, I, and I'm going to do it just because I can, to me, that's totally adverse to where we should be as a country and as a state.
Right. I want to make another point about the whole values argument too. We started out talking about Proposition 3, and some of the objections, as we said, were really completely ridiculous. Some of the objections were, well, but you know, you're putting all of this, you know, you're putting all of this in the Constitution rather than, you know, and it's a lot, and, you know, all of these kinds of objections. But I want to point out that when we're talking about values, the values should be in the Constitution, and we should have a way of working out those values. And the reason that we end up having to put more stuff into the Constitution is because there are too many people that aren't willing to follow the values of the Constitution. in carrying out their duties under it. Mm-hmm. They're more interested in imposing their own personal values. The whole idea that the U.S., for example, is a Christian nation. I mean, anybody that's read the history knows that that's just wrong. It's just a complete lie out of the right wing that they use to justify doing what they want rather than doing things that match the values of the country as a whole. Mm-hmm. And the ideals that we claim we represent.
Yes, and we should represent a religious tolerance and freedom of religion.
Absolutely.
As put in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. You know, the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, as originally adopted, mm-hmm. Including the state constitution, we took a lot of lessons from what happened overseas in England, because mm-hmm. that was their knowledge base. Mm-hmm. England and, to some degree, France for mm-hmm. the separation of powers.
Sure.
Same thing with the common law.
Right.
A lot of what our body of law mm-hmm. in almost every state, except Louisiana, mm-hmm. sure. is based on lessons learned from the way they did things in England. Mm-hmm. And they adopted the common law in the United States, and they adopted the Constitution based on past mistakes. Mm-hmm. Well, with the current makeup of our government right now, we're learning at a very rapid rate what some of the mistakes you can make in terms of authoritarianism. And I hope that we learn those well enough to adopt some of the changes that are going to be necessary to put right in the U.S. Constitution and, to some degree, the state constitutions.
Sure. Let me just say, by the way, you mentioned rightly that they copied and tried to eliminate some of the problems that they found in what their experience was in the European monarchies,
right.
as some of them were transitioning into other forms of government. But
yeah.
but remember that whole historical process is about changing from a feudal society into a mercantilist into a mercantile capitalist society. And what they did is they wanted to maintain the power of the wealthy elites.
Right.
So those are the only people that are allowed to vote. But then even those people, they didn't really trust them to maintain the power of the wealthy elites. And part of the reason that they didn't is because they saw all of the infighting and backstabbing and so on that went on in the in the European monarchies that they came from. And so what they designed was an aristocracy without a king.
True.
Where the aristocrats had a system of representing electing representatives of the aristocrats to run the government.
That's true.
That's the system that we have. And when we're talking about transitioning from that kind of a system into a system that's really a democracy or a democratic republic, I'm not at all. We can talk about republican another time, but that's a term that gets misused. But when we're talking about transforming the system that they designed, which is really all about the aristocrats, into a system that's really all about the people, we have to look at the mistakes that they made, and we have to look at how to correct those mistakes. And we're just about out of time. Any last thoughts from anybody?
Just get out and vote November 6th, 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Polls are open.
That's
right. Vote for Prop 2 and Prop 3.
Yeah.
Right.
And if you can vote absentee, because it's going to take a while.
We're expecting very long lines because we have an inadequate system, but you can vote absentee.
I want to point out is a big thank you to all the people that helped get Prop 2 and Prop 3 on the ballot.
Absolutely.
There was a tremendous amount of effort, and we want to make sure that effort is carried out to fruition, so
right.
vote. And
that's right.
Make sure your family and friends are voting, too.
Right.
Bring 5-10 people with you to the polls. Don't go alone.
That's right. Voting is a community activity. Bring your community.
That's
bring
right.
your family. Bring your friends. Let's everybody get out and vote. Yes, on 1, 2, and 3, I would argue. And have a good evening, folks. Thank you. Okay.